always about this time of year, my mind is brought back to one of the more famous humanists of our day and age, Frank Zappa. There's a song on a CD called Best Band You Never Heard in Your Life. It was the last live tour he ever did, and they didn't get very far because his equipment got stolen. But they did a very good live album, and it opens up with Heavy Duty Judy. And this time of year, I always think about that song because when I used to walk to school, it was during a big Frank Zappa phase in my life. And I'd walk to school in Larkin, you know, I'm in Elgin, I'm on my way to Larkin, and the snow would be coming down, and it was nice, the first snow of the year, and it was nice snow, and then this song started playing, and it's got a glockenspiel in it, so it sounded really good. I'd play it for you, but our licensing refuses to let us do that. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. With me today is, as usual, is Mike.
How's it going?
And Becky. Hey.
Hi. It is snowing today.
It is snowing. And I know for most of our listeners, that may not be a big deal, but man, I like the first snow of the year.
I like snow, and I would like to like snow unconditionally the way that I did when I was a kid, because then closing down the entire city meant no school.
Yeah.
But we really, in the Washington area, really got to get over this weird snow frenzy we go into every year, where it's like a terrorist threat.
I'm glad you don't remove yourself from that snow frenzy, Mike.
Well,
just saying.
I think that maybe the people in the news just have this really tight relationship with this guy who makes dangerous-looking snow graphics, and they got to get their stuff on air, but it's like even the rumor. The tone moves into something quite akin to Godzilla has been spotted, and he's moving towards Seattle.
Run, the snow comes. And, you know, you guys told me when I moved up here that the snow wouldn't be a big deal. But but every year now, there's always been a big snowfall, and everybody acts like it's the most terrifying thing they've ever experienced.
And that actually makes it a big deal, because you have to drive with those people.
Yeah, no, I understand. So
Washington!
Come visit! So, what, Becky, you've got an announcement for us.
I do have an announcement. For those of us that joined us at our Ask an Atheist benefit comedy night, The War on New Year's, friend of the show, Kathy Sorbo, is going to be directing a play called Love Bomb, My Life as a Bad Mooney. And it'll be at the Jewel Box Theater this Wednesday, January 25th at 10 p.m. And the Jewel Box is the same place we had our comedy event. And it's a lovely little theater in Belltown in Seattle.
With a nice bar.
The show's 21 plus. What is Love Bomb about? It might be of interest to those of us who listen to Ask an Atheist. It's a performance of a true story confessions sort of series of a hapless 17-year-old boy who yearns for the free love and activism of the 60s. It really is based on a true story. And it's based on David's 1979 alter ego or past life. He's an eager hippie. He takes a wrong turn at a no nukes rally, and he ends up in the boy to robot ultra cult, the Moonies. So he's totally bewitched, and he lets some details slide by. He really never stops to wonder why his new friends at the commune all dress like the Young Republicans, or what kind of hippies would constantly chant, "Ouch, Satan!" And it's proves to be really funny. He pulls off the biggest charade of the decade, bankrolled by the manic flower selling and fueled by the creepy love bombing that defined the Moonies' experience. He spends all the funds he's raised on booze, pot, and hookers.
So January 25th, Jewel Box Theater.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, well, we're going to take... this has got a really interesting topic today, so we're going to get some business out of the way right at the beginning. So stick with us. After the break, we're going to get into the presidential election.
The Steampunk Exhibition Ball is almost here. Be a part of history on Saturday, January 28th at Seattle's Museum of History and Industry. Savor the sights and sounds of local music and sultry burlesque. Sip absinthe in the Green Fairy Parlor. Swirl in the Waltzing Ballroom and strut your stuff at the costume competition. General admission and VIP tickets now on sale through Stranger Tickets. For details, visit steampunkexhibitionball.com. That's steampunkexhibitionball.com. The ball is a benefit for the Center for Sex Positive Culture. Must be 18 or older with valid ID.
Atheism TV. News, events, community, entertainment, debates, conferences. A massive repository of over 3,000 recent and fascinating atheist videos from all over the internet. Or watch The Infidel, our own regular news show. Visit the shopping area and buy something for that special atheist in your life. Or rent captivating shows, movies, and documentaries directly in your browser. Atheism TV, the world's best source of atheist videos. Visit atheismtv.com.
Billy! Billy, I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it'll explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
Sigmund Freud said, "The voice of the intellect is a soft one, but it does not rest until it has gained a hearing." Whether you're at a point in life where you are questioning your beliefs, or if you've always been an atheist or agnostic, the Auburn Freethought Society is a place where your own voice of intellect will be heard. You'll interact with like-minded people, engage in intellectual conversation, and share your experiences with others in the Auburn, Washington area. At Auburn Freethought Society, we encourage critical thought and reason. For details, find us on Facebook and on Meetup.com. Auburn Freethought Society. Have real discussion and share real ideas. Freely.
If you enjoy the programming we create here on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship helps keep our show on the air and improve the quality of our broadcasts. Donors get access to exclusive Ask an Atheist content. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
This is Ask an Atheist, and this is a subject that everybody's been asking us about if we were going to tackle it or anything like that, and yes, we are, and here is the day.
Yeah, politics. Politics, why can't you just leave us alone? We go out of our way to not talk about you, because there's too much of you on talk radio as it is, and we're trying to talk about something else, but you just keep making yourself topical. Why? And, okay, so the 2012 election. Oh, we are that far ahead. That's even worse than still writing down 2011.
Yeah.
So the 2012 election is in full swing, and religion just keeps coming up more and more as an issue in various campaigns, and it's not going away. Whether it's people opposing gay rights or calling for bans on pornography and contraception, or people talking about how God chose them to run for president, it just feels like we're in this weird fundamentalist bad idea arms race, and everyone's just trying to top the other one, saying something just meaner and dumber about religion and about God and about the place of minority religious people in this environment. So as we get towards the South Carolina primary, it's going to get a whole lot worse.
Indeed.
So to drudge through this sort of thing, we are going to consult an expert, Rob Boston. We're going to be joined by Rob Boston. He is a senior policy analyst for Americans United for Separation of Church and State and board member of the American Humanist Association. He's the author of books that include Close Encounters with the Religious Right, Journeys into the Twilight Zone of Religion and Politics. Rob Boston, welcome back to Ask an Atheist.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Rob, just to start things off, what are the ground rules for church and state separation in an election? I mean, what can a church say or not say, do or not do, if they want to keep their tax-exempt status?
Well, the IRS has been promulgating a series of rules since the mid-1950s that cover not just houses of worship, but all tax-exempt organizations. In order to keep your tax exemption, you may not intervene in an election by endorsing or opposing a candidate for public office. Now, a group can speak out on an issue, but it cannot tell people who they should vote for or against.
Okay, so those are the ground rules that the IRS sets out. One of the questions I've always had is, how likely are people going to go down? I always see people skirting the line really closely, and occasionally I see them going over. What's the political reality out there?
Well, I would like to see the IRS be a little more aggressive right now. There have in the past been some cases where they have fined religious ministries. For example, Jerry Falwell's group, Old Time Gospel Hour, back in the 80s, was fined $50,000 because they endorsed candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives. And there have been a number of other ministries and a church in New York that even lost its tax-exempt status, and that was in the early 90s. For various reasons, the IRS isn't as aggressive right now as some of us would like it to be, and we're always prodding them to get out there and look at this a little more closely, because as you point out, there aren't just people skirting the line, there are people boldly jumping over it. And there certainly is no lack of violations for the IRS to look at.
Yeah, we see a lot of this, and I remember during the last election season, Wiley Drake, who's the same guy who was calling for prayer to, I guess, kill the president, put out a statement on church letterhead where he said that a vote for Mitt Romney was a vote for Satan. Now, Mitt Romney seems to be kind of the presumptive Republican nominee. And a lot of people have come out calling, you know, his religion a dangerous cult and all that. Are we seeing more of this dangerous, this stuff that kind of crosses the line from churches against Mitt Romney or Obama or any other candidate?
Oh, yes, definitely. We've been seeing a lot of it during the primary season, and it's only going to intensify as the general election comes on. In fact, there's an organization in Arizona called the Alliance Defense Fund. It's kind of one of these right-wing, you know, legal organizations founded by TV preachers. They are urging pastors to openly violate the law. They do it every year and give sermons where they tell people who they should vote for or against, prodding the IRS to move against them. And every year when this happens, Americans United will send some of these reports to the IRS, and we're just waiting for them to get a little more aggressive in this area.
Yikes. Okay, so from my perspective, this does seem like a pretty religious primary season and more religious than previous seasons. Is this a trend that is actually occurring, or is this just my perception of what I'm seeing because I'm now an atheist activist?
No, I don't think so. I think it is a real trend. One of the things that's a little bit unusual about this year is that we have this very fluid Republican primary. And you had the early state, Iowa, and now moving on to states like South Carolina and some of the southern states, where evangelical activists are very strong. I mean, they were less so in New Hampshire, but the first state, Iowa, there's a lot of evangelical activists out in that state. So all these candidates are running on the Republican side. We're trying to court that vote, knowing that they were an important constituency. So they're always almost trying to out-God one another. if you can imagine that, them doing that, but that's what we have. And now this will quiet down if Mitt Romney continues to sort of, you know, pile up the states and eventually it becomes a lock for him. It'll probably quiet down a little bit. But right now in this very fluid primary season where almost, you know, every week somebody else was on top for a while there, they were really battling it out to get those votes.
Yeah, it feels like they're even trying to out-God previous primary battles that we've seen. Because, I mean, George W. Bush is someone who's been criticized for his coziness with the religious right, but even he never went so far as to have a prayer rally just before announcing his candidacy for president, or outright saying that evolution doesn't exist, or, you know, these guys really seem to be courting a much more aggressive, or rather regressive, style of Christianity. And do you think that that's, what do you think that's a response to? Why do you think it's getting louder and more brazen?
Well, one of the reasons that happened this year is that a number of candidates jumped into the race who had a history of courting the religious right. So you had Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, and then Rick Perry coming in, and then Michelle Bachmann, too. So there were four candidates that really had this long history of reaching out to the religious right and saying, I'm your champion, vote for me. And not all of them, of course, could be successful. So they really started to go at one another. And one of the ways they did that was, again, you know, the out-God business. And then, of course, you had people like Mitt Romney looking at this, and some of the other candidates that weren't as closely tied to the religious right, realizing that they can't let that vote slip away, so they get into the fray, and it just gets worse and worse.
So, about the subject of candidates, at what point is a candidate promising something that they can't deliver on without violating the First Amendment's Establishment Clause?
Right, that's a good question. If you look at the Supreme Court rulings in this area, there's a case from the 70s called Lemon v. Kurtzman, and in that case, the Supreme Court put down a three-part test to determine when a law violates separation of church and state. The very first prong of that test says that laws must have a secular legislative purpose. So if a lawmaker, whether it's a member of Congress or the president or even a state official, cannot enunciate a valid secular purpose for legislation, it must fail under the First Amendment. Now, some of the stuff that I'm seeing promoted right now during the campaign season, I really think is just being done to try to get votes. I mean, you can't, unless you're going to pass a constitutional amendment, you know, you can't overturn the school prayer rulings or legislation. You can't make it legal to teach creationism in the public schools through legislation. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So we're seeing a lot of posturing, but it's a lot of posturing on stuff that they can't really, that isn't really actionable.
To some extent, yes. Now, that doesn't mean that people can just blow that off or they shouldn't be concerned about it, because there are things that these candidates are able to do legislatively, because the Supreme Court hasn't actually maybe ruled definitively yet, or maybe is willing to change its mind. Consider questions choice and a woman's right to access legal abortion, which is, you know, slowly being eroded in the federal courts. And that's what all this discussion about birth control is about. You know, whenever people hear this, they think, oh, you know, these candidates are going to come and take away condoms or what have you. It's really not about that type of birth control. It's more about what are called abortifacients, which are high-dose birth control pills or Plan B pills and this sort of thing. And there is some possibility that those could be restricted in some states. Another area where they might be able to get some traction would be in the whole question of gay rights, because the courts have sort of handed down some contradictory rulings in this area. So there's some ability there to erode those regulations and those laws.
So have we seen any really blatant examples of a candidate in this election? I know we have, but I'm pretty sure Americans United has been paying pretty close attention to this. Any really blatant examples of a candidate just promising stuff that's just completely beyond the pale, that you're kind of shocked that they didn't have somebody step them aside and go, yeah, we can't say that?
Yeah, actually, I think the biggest offender there has been Newt Gingrich. I've heard him speak several times, including at a very large religious right gathering that I attended in October called the Values Voter Summit. And at that event, he put out this talk, which I've heard him give in years past, about how he was going to rein in the federal judiciary. And he was going to keep the judges, punish judges, who hand down rulings that he doesn't like regarding the separation of church and state. Now, I know it's been a long time since any one of us probably took eighth grade civics, but if you can think back that long, it's a pretty basic concept in this country that we have a separation of powers. Three branches of government, and they perform checks and balances on one another. You know, remember this from civics? The president and the Congress don't have the power to just unilaterally shut down courts that hand down rulings that displease them. I mean, if they did have that power, we would be a banana republic. And yet he's been going around and saying this. And what has surprised me is that people have they've warmed to that idea. It disturbs me. I mean, courts hand down rulings that my organization doesn't like. We don't win every case we take into the courts, and certainly we're disappointed sometimes. But we don't call for firing the judge or hauling the judge before Congress and grilling him, firing his staff, refusing to pay the bills in his office. I mean, these are all the things that Newt Gingrich has advocated. It's basically a reign of terror against the judiciary, and that is something that the president, thankfully, doesn't have the power to do.
Yeah, it really feels like Newt Gingrich is the guy who's crossing these lines, and he's kind of new to this whole religious right thing. I mean, he's not an old school person like Pat Robertson, but
I have to admit it's a bit baffling, given that I'm familiar with his earlier career, but not his current career, that he's become this kind of guy, and that he's the guy saying this when you've got a field that includes people like Bachman and Santorum and stuff like that.
Yeah, it really feels
at some point, I'm not quite sure when, but at some point a few years ago, he got on this religion kick. I think it may have been after wife number three, serial adultery, and just all the nastiness that came out of that. And he got on this kick, and he's even written a couple of books about, you know, rediscovering our great heritage of religion and so on. And it's all just a bad history that the religious right has been peddling for many decades now. And it's possible that he might have seen this as a vehicle for his political comeback. The problem is, in this particular year, as I mentioned a few moments ago, a number of other candidates who had this longer history with the religious right jumped into the race, and they were all competing for that same pie. Not everybody's going to have the whole pie. You're not going to be able to do it that way. So his message, I think, became a little more shrill in an attempt to win that audience.
Yeah, I remember him saying that he was actually afraid of this becoming a secular atheist country dominated by Islamists. I don't even know how that even works.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, that was one of his best things. It just got to the point where it wasn't really making any sense anymore, because really, if you think about it, the fundamentalist Muslims and the fundamentalist Christians have a lot more in common, certainly, than fundamentalist Muslims would have with secularists. Fundamentalist Muslims hate secularists. So it was just that on so many levels it was confusing.
Yeah, just a fundamentalist group dominating a secular country is one of the funniest things that I've probably ever seen. But yeah, it's just a crazy thing. So I have to ask this new as a guy from Americans United, I got to ask you, Rob, what are you guys thinking about this new ruling that came down from the Supreme Court where churches are now actually exempt from anti-discrimination laws?
Right, yes. Well, I wasn't in the court when that case was argued, so I heard the argument, and I walked away from it thinking that probably we were going to get a ruling very much like we did get. It's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, on one hand, I respect the right of religious organizations to make their own decisions when hiring their clergy and deciding when they don't want those clergy working for them anymore. I mean, obviously, you know, if Pastor Bob is down at the Lutheran Church and he signs up with the Mormons, they can send him packing. But the question is, can you fire a minister for reasons totally unrelated to theology?
Right.
You know, if the minister, if you decide you're too old, or even in the case of sexual harassment, and the minister speaks out against that, they can still be fired. We had some concerns about giving churches that much leeway. But the Supreme Court has said that it is permissible, and it's actually, because it was a unanimous ruling, it's pretty narrow. You know, this is a Supreme Court that is very closely divided on church-state issues. There have been a lot of decisions that have been 5-4 in recent years. So when you get a unanimous ruling from the Supreme Court, you can pretty much bet that something a little bit unusual is going on. And in this case, to get that unanimous ruling, they crafted a pretty narrow decision. If you read the opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, he even basically says at one point, well, there are a lot of questions that are going to come out of this whole situation. We'll decide those later.
Do we think that they might try to leverage this decision? Because I know another big issue that's been popping up is basically taxpayer funding going towards churches for contracts that they may have to provide some sort of service. Do you think that they might actually try to leverage this decision to try to say, oh, well, you can't take away our ability to do, you know, adoptions because we refuse to give adoptions to, say, a same-sex couple?
I do, yes. In fact, I think that's among the situations that Chief Justice Roberts is admitting will surface before the court again. If you think about religious groups in modern life, they have extended their reach beyond their own doors and their own pulpits.
Yeah.
If you think about social services, for example, many of those are now provided by religious groups acting on contracts from the state. Now, we can argue about whether this is good or bad. I have my concerns about it, but it's a reality of life today. Many of those organizations hire people outside their own faith community to perform this provision of services. The question becomes, will they have the right to start firing people even though the work they are doing has nothing to do with religion? Let's say you're running a soup kitchen for people in need, and your job is basically just, you know, ladling out the soup and organizing the food and getting into the hands of people who need it. No praying, no theology, no preaching. Can they start firing you even though your duties are not religious at all? Those are the types of questions that are going to come before the court again. And when they do, I don't think we're going to see unanimous rulings then. I think we'll see splits.
That was a concern of mine. Is I know in this specific case, they were trying to rule that an educator was suddenly a clergy person and thus was subject to the same rule sets. And the other side of that is, like you said, in this day and age, the dogma and the rule sets for these religions have become so all-encompassing, as in the last 50 years or so, religions have sort of gotten into politics, and the churches are now playing the political game. It becomes difficult to figure out where they're allowed to make these decisions based upon their doctrine, and where they're not allowed, where it's not a clergy person and just a lay person who's ladling out soup.
Right, exactly. In this case, the teacher who brought this case had sought special status. It was a Lutheran church, and she sought special status as something called a called teacher, which does have ministerial functions, and that complicated her case. I mean, she went through a course of study. She had to appear before a board and prove that she had the right religious credentials. So she was in a quasi-ministerial performance right there. The question becomes, in all of these jobs that are totally unrelated to religion, and also, too, as you mentioned, we get into this issue of religious organizations operating on behalf of the government with a contract funded by the state, deciding that they don't want to provide services to certain people. In the state of Illinois, for example, the Catholic Church was handling foster care in a number of counties in the state.
Right.
And they suddenly decided that they weren't going to place any foster children with same-sex couples, even though these couples were perfectly qualified to provide the care. And in fact, they were needed because there aren't a lot of people willing to provide foster care. Yet they just uniformly said, no, if you're a same-sex couple, you're not going to be able to provide this. We're not going to do it. And the state came in and said, well, you have to. You must. The contract states you must provide this service to same-sex couples as well as opposite-sex couples. So the church pulled out. Now, they grumbled a lot, and they complained a lot, and other types of organizations stepped in to fill the gap. The question becomes, will they start arguing, or even going into court, and saying, well, we have a right to this, to do this, even though we're not going to serve everybody?
Yeah, I think they're certainly going to make that argument. I know Newt Gingrich, again, that name is coming up, made a big stink about Catholic churches and other things and groups having to pull these sort of services. But nobody has a right to a government contract. Nobody, you sign on or you're not, that there's a trade-off that comes with taking public funds, taxpayer funds. There are certain things you're not allowed to do anymore as a consequence of somebody else paying for what you're doing.
For those of us who work...
It's just audacious what some of these church leaders think. Let's go back to the Catholic Church, for example. They had a contract for the Department of Health and Human Services to provide services to victims of trafficking. Now, many people who are victims of trafficking have been sexually abused, you know, raped, forced into prostitution, whatever. They need access to a complete health care range, including contraceptives. And the church wasn't going to provide the contraceptives. So they lost the contract. Now, they've been going around complaining that that's religious discrimination because they weren't willing to provide all the services. Now, think about all the secular organizations that provide services to the government. If you are told that you need to provide, you know, A, B, and C to get the contract, and you only are willing to provide A and B, I can guarantee you're not going to get the contract. Why should religious groups be held to a different standard where they can ignore provisions in the contract yet still get it? That's not discrimination. That's just common sense.
That's absolutely true. Again, Bob, Rob, I want to thank you. Rob Boston, he's a senior policy analyst for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Thanks again for coming on the show, and we hope to hear from you again in the future.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Great talking with you. So, part one.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It is, and it's interesting the kind of things that they'll call discrimination. I can't fulfill the contract. That's discrimination.
I'm a victim of persecution because I'm not allowed to tell other people what to do with government money.
And that's privilege. Ask an Atheist. We're going to go into a break, and then we'll talk to you. See you in a couple minutes.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Don't believe in God? Join the club. Humanists, atheists, and freethinkers have joined the American Humanist Association since 1941 to advocate for progressive values and equality for non-theists in America. Located in Washington, D.C., the American Humanist Association lobbies Congress on humanist issues, protects the rights of atheists in the courts, and supports more than 140 local chapters. Visit us at AmericanHumanist.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter to learn how you can join the club today.
Did you know that not a single psychic or paranormal event has ever been reproduced?
Have you ever wondered about the effectiveness of faith healing, Reiki, or sports bracelets?
Was 9/11 an inside job, or is that all just another unproven conspiracy theory?
Come check out the Seattle Skeptics, a group focused on lively debates and a critical examination of pseudoscience, alternative medicine, and anything else that hasn't held up to the light of the scientific method.
Seattle Skeptics was created for those who require a higher bar of evidence than gut feelings or blind belief.
We're not contrarians or cynics, we just want to see the evidence.
And so should you.
Check us out at seattleskeptics.org.
That's seattleskeptics.org.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing, but that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communication succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
Join us after today's show at the Office Bar and Grill in downtown Tacoma. Offering a wide selection of tap and bottled beer, a full bar of your favorite liquor, and a taste bud tantalizing menu, come on down and shoot the breeze with the Ask an Atheist crew. Who can argue with your motives? After all, you're at the office. The Office Bar and Grill is at 813 Pacific Avenue in Tacoma.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480, but don't actually call in, it's just second nature.
It's okay. I work in retail, so I know that that instinct really well.
Yeah, yeah. So this week we're talking about politics and the 2012 election.
Yeah, because religion will not leave the 2012 election alone.
No, it will not.
We don't want to talk about your 2012 election. Why can't you just go away? So to help us deal with this, on the phone with us we have Sean Faircloth, who really has a hell of a resume. He's a former majority whip of the Maine State Legislature, the former executive director of the Secular Coalition for America, and he is now the director of strategy and policy for the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. He's the author of the new book, Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All, and What We Can All Do About It. Sean, welcome back to Ask an Atheist.
Good to be here. Good to talk to you.
So, tell us about Attack of the Theocrats. When you say theocrats, who are we talking about here?
Well, most essentially in the last 40 years, I'd say, the religious right has made a concerted effort to affect the political process in the United States. They've run people for the school board and the legislatures and city councils, and they've had significant success beyond their numbers, you know. So they use the term, or used to use the term, moral majority. I don't think they're moral, and they're not the majority either, and never have been. But they have tremendous organizing power and fundraising power, and they've been running people for office and with success. Certainly a culmination was President Bush, who cited to the President of France the Book of Revelations regarding his decisions on Iraq. That was certainly a pinnacle point of religiosity and policy. But in some ways, I'm even more concerned about what people don't pay so much attention to. That is at the state legislature level and at members of Congress level, which I write about in my book. And a lot of times those go under the radar, and people would be shocked, I think, to just know the sheer number of theocratic politicians and theocratic laws that are already elected and already on the books.
Like, what kind of laws are we talking about here?
Well, you name the topic. I mean, whether you look at issues of, believe it or not, land use planning and environmental law, there's a federal law that provides a religious bias in that regard. There was an outrageous ruling, outrageous in the fact that it was probably correctly decided, unfortunately, because of the way the statute's written, but gave a megachurch in the Colorado area, Boulder, Colorado area, the ability to ignore laws passed locally that others have to obey. And that's just one example. In children's law, there's multiple examples. Bias that allows, in the majority of states, for so-called faith healing to have a lesser standard of care for children in child protection law. In some states, child care centers, because they're religious, don't have to obey the state law. Vaccination exemptions based on religion in the vast majority of states. Stem cell research thwarted. I could go on, and I have in my book an entire chapter that covers numerous examples of laws on the books, ways that I think would affect almost every one of your listeners and their family and friends in some way, and yet a lot of people just aren't even aware of it.
Yeah, we've talked a lot on this show about religious privilege, you know, folks who basically what they have is they have this privileged position in culture and in our society, and like, for instance, certain laws just don't apply, or they apply much more liberally, to, I guess, use the term, to them than to almost anyone else. Like, I've seen a lot of instances where a person's atheism becomes a subject of a custody battle.
Yeah.
And ends up becoming something that denies them custody. And it feels like really this kind of thing where people are screaming persecution in the face of their privilege being taken away, their ability to dominate other people being taken away. Do you think that this is why the religious right may be getting more aggressive in current years?
Well, they know that in reality, their numbers have not really grown over the last 20 years in terms of fundamentalist or evangelical Protestants.
Quite.
But yet their political influence has remained steady and strong. I mean, there really has been nothing more extreme than the Iowa presidential caucus, and now we're seeing similar things in South Carolina. Essentially, they have veto power over one of two major political parties in the most powerful nation in the history of the world. I mean, it's amazing stuff. In part, it's sort of an iron triangle. I call it the religio-industrial complex. I mean, back when they had the parsonage exemption, just to take one example in the tax code, people would picture, the modest parsonage residence for the minister, the humble little cottage. But they get exemption from their income and an amount equal to the mortgage of a resident, so that you don't have to count it as income. And it's really a tremendous boon. But, you know, now with the explosion, and I talk about this in my book, the real explosion in the last 30 years of megachurches, you see real mansions, really gorgeous homes, and there's no upper limit to this exemption, so that you, basically taxpayers can be forced and are forced in many, many more cases than used to be true to subsidize a wealthy pastor's home. So picture some pastors out there saying, you know, gays must be shunned and women must be subordinate. For his swanky home, we're all helping to foot the bill.
Yeah.
It's outrageous.
Rich Lyons actually might have something to say about that back when he was pastor, an evangelical pastor. But one of the questions I have about the sort of the stranglehold religion has on local politics, I mean, how much does their local infrastructure, the fact that they've got local infrastructure when those of us in sort of newer secular movements don't quite have it? Like, when I go to vote here in Washington State, I go to a church. I mean, how much does that play into it?
Right. No, it's pervasive in the culture, and certainly the megachurches have worked to wield their influence in a highly organized fashion. They have a book called Pastorpreneur out that maybe most of your listeners would not have heard of. In some ways, I admire it. In some ways, it horrifies me because they basically talk about it as sort of a business enterprise that they're involved with. And, you know, these aren't the dusty old churches of, you know, some of the old mainline liberal Protestant churches. Frankly, their demographics have really fallen off in recent years. But these folks build a political influence and have a political force and run the candidates. And I mean, the whole character of the state of Iowa, for example, is different than it used to be. The influence of fundamentalism in Iowa, just to take that recent caucus state, is different in character than it was, say, back in Jimmy Carter's time when he was the first candidate to make a big deal about the Iowa caucuses. It's a change in the nature of our culture. And I think people like Biden not too long ago said, well, it wouldn't make that much difference to remove the exemption. Because I think he lives, you know, he was elected to Congress around 1970 when this was a much less big of a deal
right.
than today.
So it is the presidential race just kind of the ultimate example of this kind of coming to fruition, you know, this 40 years of them building power? Because it feels like at least half of the candidates for president now are making theocratic promises like banning contraception or instituting God's law. When did candidates like this go from being these sort of sideshows to becoming frontrunners?
In my book, I quote, at the beginning of each chapter, I juxtapose quotes from two different leaders to sort of frame some of the issues. And one person that I quote more than once is Barry Goldwater, who said, I believe, I'll paraphrase, but I have no respect for the religious right. He wouldn't have a chance in a Republican primary. Here's the guy who was the epitome of right-wing conservatism, the founder of it in many people's minds, and he wouldn't be allowed in a Republican primary. And now it's ironic, and I'm going to be talking more about this, but Mitt Romney, you know, you have some in the fundamentalist community critical of him, but really, he's checked almost all of their boxes, too. He's flipped his flop so much to their liking. And my own opinion is probably, it's sort of, when was Mitt Romney a hypocrite? And I agree with some conservatives that probably he was a hypocrite when he was governor of Massachusetts, and that actually the move to the right is more in keeping with his his innate character, so that, you know, he was a hypocrite then, not now, kind of thing.
Right.
But that he's, you know, even for them, they'll criticize him, but really he's almost already checked most of their boxes. There are a couple of extreme boxes he hasn't checked because he knows those won't play in a national election, but he's had to check pretty much all of them, you know, very few that he's left off.
It really feels like somebody becomes a front runner. I guess that I've heard it described that the Republican primary has two divisions, Romney and not Romney, and that the not Romney place is the one that's creating this sort of, I guess you could say, constantly changing series of front runners that we've had over the last year. And that the funny thing is, a lot of the time they lose ground on something that to a general audience would seem somewhat reasonable, like Rick Perry supporting the distribution of HPV vaccines in Texas, but they went nuts about that.
They did.
Yeah, I actually, when I was in the Maine legislature, introduced similar legislation at the time that he was doing it. Now, of course, the backstory on him is that he had a buddy who was a big lobbyist and who had previously worked for him, and lo and behold, is one of Romney's, in my view, few intelligent moves, but it seemed to be motivated by that one happened to be something a pharmaceutical company wanted, and so that was his, may have been his motive, but...
Corruption in the political process? Gasp.
But it sort of ironically resulted in one time where he did something that was right, but of course he quickly denounced himself.
There's been a lot of self-denunciations. It seems kind of like they're trying to find this, you know, perfect example of somebody who believes everything possibly unreasonable at the same time, where it really feels like they're getting kind of crazier. And, I mean, am I wrong in feeling like, I mean, George Bush would speak in code about his doubt about evolution, but now we have candidates straight out saying they think it's a myth. The same thing with global warming and a lot of other things. And am I just seeing this wrong, or is it just getting crazier?
No, I think it's true that there's never been another as high a watermark for the theocratic movement in this country. And I hope that we will take this as an opportunity to point this out. And that really is the goal of my book, because underneath the surface of this high watermark, if you will, there are all these laws that are already on the books, and most people aren't aware of them. And the concept for me of this book was, we know, or I think rational assessment of the evidence leads to the conclusion that Richard Dawkins is right, that the late Christopher Hitchens is right. The question now is, what do we do about it, particularly in American society? What's next? And I wrote this book as sort of an easy toolkit. So you find out, here's the laws you can talk to your neighbors about, so that they don't just view us as, oh, we're against the cross on the hill somewhere on public land, which I'm against and is unconstitutional, but that I want our neighbors and friends to say, oh, yeah, people are really hurt. And I really tried to bring home the realities of how people are harmed by religious bias, and not just the non-religious. Lots of other people, including, of course, children in fundamentalist homes, are harmed by religious bias in American law, and then a plan, a specific plan to move us to a secular future.
So it sounds like there are, rather than viewing the crosses at the interstates and the nativity scenes at state capitals, rather than seeing these as isolated incidents in religious privilege, that it's part of a larger fabric that's been with us since the foundation of the country and manifests itself not only in these clear social events, but also laws.
Right, that this pervasiveness of religious privilege and law has been able to largely slip under the radar. It's the nature of the media and of the public. We like the easy, here's the horse race for president, and we all focus on that, and of course, it's quite reasonable that we do. But meanwhile, they passed a bunch of crazy laws and legislatures that almost none of the media has covered, and that really undermine the nature of the republic. I mean, we are unique as a nation. It was Jefferson and Madison who first were able to get this concept of separation of church and state into the actual law of a country. There have been a couple of philosophers who suggested the concept, but they were the first ones to actually pull it off. And it's ironic and sad that in this nation that really brought this concept to the fore, and it's a great and valuable one, that it's being so dramatically undermined here in the United States of America. And it's really up to us those of us who are secular, to start truly organizing and influencing society. And that's really a big part of the mission of this book, with a specific plan, but also my work as director of policy and strategy is to really help build this grassroots movement. Because until we have that, our influence will remain disproportionately small.
Yeah, so we were talking earlier, Sean, and you mentioned that the Richard Dawkins Foundation is actually having a contest coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. This coming Thursday is the deadline, and we've noticed it, for a month and a half or so now. But basically, I talk in my book and in some speeches that you can see about a 10-point vision of a secular America. And the concept of this 10-point vision is really to take the moral high ground rather than, oh, you naysayers, you people who criticize and don't have something positive to say, which I don't think is true, but to try to encapsulate that in this 10-point vision, which is about, sadly, 10 ways that religious bias exists in American law today, but the positive vision of what that America would look like once we do the right thing and rejuvenate our secular heritage. And the contest is just people who might do a YouTube video or something that somehow can inspire people to participate in support of the 10-point vision and a plan for a secular future. And the winners of that contest actually will be able to get 2 free plane tickets from wherever they are in the United States to meet Richard Dawkins when he's in the United States. And so it'll be kind of fun, and not only 2 free plane tickets, but to meet Richard Dawkins. And really with the goal of a social movement, of how we can all work together to build a social movement that has an impact on American society.
Yeah, I think the real irony of a lot of the stuff we're seeing from Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachmann is that in their aggressiveness, I think they're only going to help other people realize that the option of sort of a secular, socially progressive future is just much more appealing.
We are on the right side of history, as Jagger might say, time is on our side. Demographically, since 1990, we're the only group that's grown in all of the 50 states of the Union. We're raising kids. Those kids, in turn, tend to be more secular. The trends are very good. But where we've really fallen down, and what I hope my book, Attack of the Theocrats, helps to address, is really taking the pragmatic nuts and bolts, political strategizing and grassroots organizing and fundraising effort to have an effect on American society. You know, my plan's called Our Secular Decade, which is, you know, giving us some years. We're talking about through to the year 2020 is the concept in the plan. So it's giving us some years to do it, but it's nonetheless ambitious, pragmatically ambitious, to get us to the goals of a secular America. And sometimes I hear in the non-religious community of all various stripes sort of people throwing up their hands and saying, well, you know, you look at how powerful the religious right is, we'll never get there. But I mean, if you were a gay person in 1968, you would have reason to think, wow, it's really looking like an uphill battle, and indeed... It was, but with organizing, with thinking, and here's a group, frankly, that as a percentage of population is smaller than our percentage of population, but yet they organized, they worked, and they had success.
Yeah.
All the analogies don't fit on all fours, but nonetheless, I think we should be optimistic, and the first step, and something I hope to help contribute, is really, I want to help, for lack of a better term, out Ralph Reed, that we need that organizing component to our movement, political savvy component to our movement. We can't just say, oh, you guys are wrong and we're right. We got to move beyond that.
That was the thing I was noticing, is that we're, you know, you're using your book as a starting point to show this sort of substrate of privilege that works in the, you know, the government, the local governments and the national government of the United States. But then this contest that you're working on seems like a way to sort of going forward, build a fabric in which we can talk about it and address it and come up and strategize into the future about how we're going to change this and get back on the right track.
Exactly. I think there are millions of Americans, including some liberal religionists, who would be very sympathetic and are sympathetic to what our viewpoints and values are. But in some ways, I don't think we've marketed those as effectively. And I know sometimes, especially, you know, we evidence-based folks, our hair stands up on end. We've talked about marketing, trying to persuade the public, and there's a speech that's at richarddawkins.net. I talk about atheism, a new strategy, in which I talk about directly speaking to people's emotions. And I've heard people say, oh, geez, we don't do that. That's totally the opposite of our method. And I disagree. I feel like we should definitely be evidence-based, but if so long as we are based on sound data to evoke emotions, to get people to care about individual stories. In my book, I tell specific stories about, you know, a little child dying at a child care center that's a religious child care center, and how the religious child care centers in some states are given leeway to basically ignore the law, and that can lead to much neglect, but in some extreme cases, death. But to really tell that individual story, to try to hit people where they live, make people have an emotional reaction, and then say, oh, and by the way, it's not just this one girl who died, which is very horrible in and of itself. It is representative of a whole issue that is backed up by data. And I think we need to be able to do that more than has been our tendency in the past.
Absolutely. I mean, you'll find no argument from me in about marketing or the necessity of addressing things emotionally sometimes. I'm an evidence-based person. You know, my show is called Ask an Atheist, but I'm also an emotional person. We're not Vulcans. You know, I mean, we really do need to talk about how we feel about things at times. It just, you know, we need to understand that when we're talking about how we feel, we're not talking about evidence.
Yeah, and I
well,
oh, I'm just saying I absolutely agree, is that you have to hit somebody in the gut before you hit them in the brain sometimes. And
yeah.
I just want to say thank you, Sean. This has been Sean Faircloth. He is the Director of Strategy and Policy for the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, author of the new book, Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It.
So, Sean,
you can pick up a copy right now at Amazon or for Nook. They're available. Or at the Richard Dawkins website, you can get a copy of the book.
Very good. And if they want to enter into your contest, where should they go?
The Richard Dawkins website, richarddawkins.net. And there you can see the contest rules and the deadline. And we'd love to have people throw in a video.
I look forward to checking it out. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's been a heavy day.
I like putting it in that context where religious privilege is not just something that we're seeing now in nativity scenes and crosses by the side of the road, but despite all the work that the secular end of the foundation of our country is, there's this privilege has been with us the whole time, and it shows itself in law, in, like, you know, in fitness to have children, and it's all over the place, and we really don't just need to stop it where we see it in a whack-a-mole fashion, that we actually need to dig down and change the substrate.
You have to rip the root out.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where they've had this cultural dominance, this unreasonable cultural dominance for so long, that when that dominance is taken away, not their rights,
yeah,
their right to practice their beliefs and even limit their own behavior is the same as it's always been. They can choose to not marry a gay person, not eat meat on Friday, not eat pork, whatever. They're allowed to still not eat meat on Friday,
yeah,
not marry a gay person. But they don't have that right to project those beliefs on other people unwillingly using the law.
The whole point of this exercise is that you know, we get to live the way we wish to live within the law, and they get to live the way they wish to live within the law, as long as we're not hurting other people and we're following the Bill of Rights and et cetera, et cetera. But when you start writing laws that say you must live in this specific way following this specific dogma, then it's not really freedom anymore at that point.
They're so used to having their way and being able to tell people to believe, or not necessarily to believe, but to obey their rules.
Yeah.
That when their ability to dominate is taken away, they actually have the gall to play the persecuted victim.
But I find it very interesting, even in a part of the world that I find really interesting, you know, broadcasting. There are a lot of laws that favor religious organizations in broadcasting, especially like the LPFM movement, where it was basically designed from the ground up for churches. They don't have to, it has to be a nonprofit organization, and it has to be done in a way where, you know, where it's really easy to church to have one of these small radio stations, but anybody else, they're kind of out in the dark, and then these churches just bring in other content from all these mega churches and these huge Christian organizations from the seven satellites, which beam nothing but Jesus, Jesus, Jesus into your head 24 hours a day. I mean, it's very strange.
Tax-exempt status is incredibly easy to get if you're a religious organization, much harder to get if you're a secular organization.
Having been at the helm, or at least part of the helm, of a few nonprofits, yeah, it's incredibly difficult to get that status, and it's incredibly difficult to hold that status.
You want
to
keep it and have it? Put a cross on your roof. That's the easiest way to get it.
So, specifically in the context of the 2012 election, though, to sort of get out of that substrate and get into the now, the Secular Coalition for America has recently put out their presidential candidate scorecard.
Yeah, this one is actually kind of interesting because nobody does particularly very well at it. They actually looked at them on a number of topics, attitudes towards non-theist, church-state separation, taxpayer funding, and there's even a question about whether they accept evolution or whether they think that God is commanding them or making them the sort of chosen, you know, I guess, vessel of the divine.
Right, right.
And nobody comes out of this looking particularly well. I will say Michelle Bachmann, who's since dropped out, is the lone person to get straight Fs.
Yeah, yeah.
Though there are a couple candidates that did really, really well. Well, Santorum actually got a C in one place.
Yeah, he did.
But the rest of them were Fs. But there's some really bad ones. And those atheist supporters of Ron Paul should probably read this.
Definitely check it out.
But even Huntsman and Obama, who probably did better than anyone else, still incredibly spotty on this. Check out on secular.org. You can actually read the candidate statement in full.
All right, this is Ask an Atheist. We're going to be meeting at the office at 5 o'clock, so feel free to come out with us. My name is Sam Olde. With me today was Mike Gillis and Rebecca Friedman. Music by Chris Coleman. Production assistant Jeremy Whitman, as usual. Thank you very much to Rob Boston and Sean Fairclough. We love talking to you guys. It's a great time. Ask an Atheist is an NEDM Media production. You can give us a call at 206-420-0997. We will see you in an hour at the office.
And on the show next week, James Randi.